Hopefully we'll have time today for a good number of questions. Look, there's a little stand to sit your latte on, a well-designed pulpit. Unfortunately, it shows, so people know what you're drinking, which may be a good idea in the case of some pastors. As we think about religion and science, we have reviewed the fact that traditional Christian faith not only is not hostile to science, but that the doctrine of the incarnation became a catalyst when combined with important work done by Greco-Roman philosophers to the creation of science. And the Reformation in the Reformation countries of Europe helped seal the deal. We pointed out that what looked to us as relatively simple ideas, like the scientific method, took centuries to work out. Simple ideas in mathematics, if you don't gain them, make the rest of mathematics impossible to understand. But the simple ideas, sort of like the invention of the wheel, are not so easy to come up with. Once you have them, then anybody can do them. But the simple ideas that produced the scientific revolution, the hard work of people like Roger Bacon, William Grosseteste, and others, took centuries to develop. And we saw that Christianity was an integral part of that, even in the Islamic contributions to science. Since the Islamic contributions themselves were in part, along with brilliant Muslim philosophers, based on the influence of Christian preservation of Greco-Roman texts and continued Christian thought about religion and science, beauty and architecture. So that Christianity was involved in the process of developing science in every way, shape, and form. The second thing that I pointed out yesterday is that epistemology, the theory of knowledge, is sometimes seen as a sort of two-pole game where you should always do what appears to be the most reasonable thing. But I think through several examples I showed that it's not irrational to root for a thing that appears to be less reasonable if the outcome is so favorable. Now, of course, eventually you'd get to a point, like playing a lottery in California, where your bet is a really bad one, where your investment is so unlikely to pay off that no matter how awesome the outcome, you shouldn't bother. I would take it that belief in the Loch Ness Monster, while interesting, has the current existence anyway of a large beast in Loch Ness, becomes so unlikely that the pleasure isn't worth what you'd have to do mentally in order to sustain that belief. Now, a question I didn't get yesterday, but often get at a hostile university that I want to begin with, is, come on, Reynolds, if you do things like that, why don't we believe in Santa Claus or Superman or the Easter Bunny? And my general response is, if you want to believe in Santa Claus, go for it, if that provides you psychic pleasure. However, the difficulty with your decision to go on believing in Santa Claus is that maintaining that belief will have a very, very high epistemological cost for the amount of pleasure you get. What you're going to have to do mentally on Christmas Eve is create evidence out of whole cloth. To the best of my knowledge, there's never been a serious person, an adult person, who has been able to maintain belief in Santa Claus, which I think is a relevant point. Now, I want you to hear what I'm saying exactly. On my epistemology, you should default to wanting to believe in Santa Claus. Don't go crazy. Hear me out. So you want to believe in Santa Claus. The only problem is, I don't know an adult who can actually maintain a belief in Santa Claus while remaining sane. Does that make sense? It isn't that we don't want to believe in Santa Claus or Superman. It is that we have proven All adult human beings, to the best of my knowledge, who are otherwise sane, have proven incapable of believing something, even if they wanted to keep believing it. If your parents told you about Santa Claus, you might remember being 8 or 9, 10 years old, nowadays maybe more like 6 or 7, with exposure to media, and coming to have doubts in the existence of Santa. And then slowly over time, the belief in Santa, however much you wanted to believe it, proved to be unsustainable. If you can believe a pleasant thing, what I'm saying is you should go on trying to maintain that belief until the cost to your theory of knowledge becomes too high. But my suggestion is no one in this room is capable of sustaining a belief in Santa Claus. On the other hand, let's take the existence of God as compared to Santa, the Easter Bunny, or Superman. People in this room have shown an ability to sustain a belief in the existence of God, despite some evidence, the best evidence being the existence of evil. By the way, that's the existence of evil. Is that an argument against the existence of God? No. It's an argument against a particular God, namely a God that's simultaneously omnipotent and is good and omniscient. Plato's God of Timaeus is not subject to problem of evil arguments as a divine craftsman because he cannot work with the perversity of the universe. Matter in the Timaeus is perverse in the sense that like is attracted to like, little bits of matter just want to come together. And whether it's rational or not for that to happen, they want to do that. So God is trying to make things be orderly. And what is matter trying to do? Become homogeneous. All come together. And so God is always pushing matter apart and trying to keep the universe an interesting place. But Plato's God isn't all-powerful. Why does evil exist then for Plato? Because God wants it to exist? No, because his God can't do anything about it. By the way, sometimes contemporary theologians who are opposed to traditional Christian thought about God will argue that Greek philosophy overly influenced the development of Christian doctrine. Those same people will argue against God's foreknowledge and omnipotence, his ability to take care of certain problems like evil in the universe, and argue that those concepts were importations of Greek philosophy. What they sometimes don't realize is they've simply recapitulated Plato's demiurgos, divine craftsman from the Timaeus. It's pretty impossible to escape Greek philosophy in one way because the Greeks explored most of the viable options that even exist to this day. Atheism to a monotheistic God. So they have in fact not escaped the problem of influence by Greek philosophy. But that's an aside. What's the point of this? The problem of evil argues against a particular God. Namely, the Judeo-Christian God. And I think it's a good argument. It's the most powerful argument if I were to become an atheist or an agnostic. It's the main reason I would become one. You can make theism work with Darwinism or evolutionary theory if that's what you want. I don't think you should, given my view of Christianity and the Bible. But you could make that work. There are very few ideas that you can't, with sufficient cleverness, shoehorn together. So there are some arguments against the existence of God, some reasons to doubt that God exists. I'll tell you this right now, particularly when I was a younger adult, I would occasionally wake up in the night, stare at the bunk bed in my dorm in Bible college over my head and think, am I just praying in my own head? Does God exist? Is this a fantasy, a fraud that I've fallen into from the first century? And there are probably many people in this room, I won't ask you to show hands and get expelled from seminary, who periodically have doubts. In fact, my dad, who's pastored for 46 years, is a believer, will say, anytime he faces a severe question of evil, there will be some part of him that says, how, God, how could this happen? And doubt this is not a bad thing. This is a natural reaction in our fallen state to our ignorance, our inability to see what God is doing. It's that skepticism that should be running parallel to everything we do. Now notice, despite this good, healthy skepticism, that this side of paradise causes us to pause, that is the mother of so much good theological reflection, see Job, as we try to wrestle with God's ways with humankind. That despite this, you've been able to sustain a belief in God, unlike your ability to sustain a belief in Santa, which means what I would call an epistemology of belief may cause you to believe things a little too long, but doesn't lead inevitably to believing that there are elves that live in hollow trees and make cookies. Now, I would really like it if there were elves who lived in trees and made cookies. I think that's a cool belief. I wish it were true. However, I have found that even if I want to sustain a belief that that's true, or that Narnia is in my closet, I've been unable to sustain that belief. And this counts, I think. Now, bottom line then, with what I'm suggesting to you is this. It's better to be occasionally cheated, but trusting, than to never be cheated and solitary. The person who is absolutely skeptical will be unable to build civilization and community. If you cannot be cheated, you cannot do business. As we look at people like Madoff, who cheated so many intelligent people, people are now, reporters, writing learned articles about how to avoid being defrauded by your financial advisor. I'd like to make a suggestion. If you get to the point where your financial advisor cannot defraud you, you should become your own financial advisor. I have to go do my taxes. I began that process last week with my accountant. And if he doesn't tell me the truth, I'm doomed. I don't understand my taxes. I'm not sure my accountant understands my taxes, given American tax law. Hey, the next time somebody complains about the Old Testament and God's rigor, you should point out that there are more regulations around one line of the tax code than in the entire Old Testament. The God of the Bible is exceedingly libertarian. The God of Washington wants to run every aspect of your life if we're not careful. So what is a Christian to do? A Christian is bound in this life to be wrong and cheated because fundamentally, when we see another human being, what's our first thought? Look, a soul created in the image of God. I love that man or woman. Let's make him a brother or sister in Christ. It's not, I wonder how he's going to mess me up. If you go into a classroom with your professors and you are too much of a Berean, so that you have, haven't you known students like this? You have your Bible out and you're waiting for heresy. I know seminary professors. They're here to liberalize me, and I'm not going to let it happen. Well, it's true. You will never get a liberal arts education that way. In fact, I think you'll never get an education at all. You'll be so untrusting that you won't be able to expand, think, look around things. So my suggestion is that Christians will always appear to be less wise than the skeptic, but will sure as heck be nicer to know and capable of producing a civilization in which skeptics are essentially useful parasites. Now, why are they useful? Because like McPhee, in C.S. Lewis's wonderful novel, That Hideous Strength, who doesn't believe anything that's going on in the house and is incapable of acting for righteousness, Skeptics deflate our balloon occasionally. They ask the hard questions that maybe our trust will cause us not to ask. The best friend creationists have, in one way, are those folks at Panda's Thumb or in other places that every time we try to do something, what do? Mock, ridicule, and act as a kind of unpaid critic for everything we write. Now, some of it's toxic and nasty. But if we have strong self-images and love of God should chase away any insecurity, we couldn't pay people to referee everything we do because we don't have the money. If you don't believe how positive this can be, let me say that Disney, which is dominant in the area where I live, has many giant fanboys. But they're fanboys who are now incapable of enjoying Disneyland. They're only capable of critiquing it. I am capable of going to Disneyland, suspending my criticisms, my philosophical mind, and enjoying the park. But there's a certain kind of person who sits in the restaurant and counts the number of people, I'm not making this up, at the restaurant, reports the number and times the speed of the service. They're fans of the park in a skeptical sense. They go through a ride and they look for every feature that's not working so they can blog it. Do you think Disneyland minds those fans? Do you think they want to crush those fans if they're wise? What are those fans, quote-unquote fans, doing for Disneyland? They're providing free, unpaid, quality control for the park. And so the park reads those blogs and uses it to decide what they need to paint, where they need to go. It's not the only thing they do. They have their own internal skeptics and critics. But you know how this goes. The fanboys can spot a problem long before the paid person because they love the park in a weird sort of way. In the same way, Dawkins and Dennett and Christopher Hitchens' obsession with Christianity is a useful thing. I'm glad I don't have to do that job. Do you want to sit around and be the paid in-house critic of this seminary? But you don't have to do it because sad and lonely people, incapable of doing anything positively themselves, have embraced an epistemology that make them useful to this seminary forever. As they look at your mistakes, as you're defending the West, they're critiquing the defenders of the West. But don't you want to wipe the stain off your armor if it's in the back and you never noticed it? See, an epistemology of belief will make you capable of missing problems that the skeptic in God's economy, your Satan, can be used to point out. So the good news is, so long as they're agnostics, atheists, or liberal Christians, you don't have to do that job. And in paradise, where they've all vanished, where they've gone to their own place, where they will be equally critical, you can be assured, writing long, learned papers about how badly run hell is. Hell, it's a hell of a thing. Bishop Spong will have conferences. You can just imagine. You'll have to go to conferences with the Episcopal Bishop John Spong for all of eternity. There's a certain kind of justice there. No, all kidding aside, the point is in paradise, we won't need this because the universe, which right now groans in travail, it's out of order. The fig tree doesn't produce figs when the Son of Man wants figs. We live in the wreckage of Eden and of the pre-flood world. Nothing is as it was. It's weaker. Everything is a shadow of the pre-flood world, which is a shadow of Eden. We're degeneration twice and slowly running down until the second coming. And still, how marvelous is God's creation. How beautiful, how fit, how orderly. Because fundamentally, though we're broken, the divine structure is still more glorious than the brokenness. So that the heavens can still declare the glory of God, however imperfect they are. Why then, given all this epistemology, given all this history, would I still want to be a young earth creationist? And I'll try, just in the brief time we have, to sketch out for you the reason I would want to believe something, but I want to make an admission right from the start that probably has gotten me in more trouble than anything else I've ever said. Based solely on the interpretations of scientific evidence that currently exist, following the rules that Christians created and should agree to play by when they do science, based solely on those considerations, I would be an evolutionist. Now, why then am I not one? For the same reason that science by itself cannot decide what kind of research it should engage in. It's a different issue, but let me point out that the fact that a scientist wants to do some stem cell research, sees value in stem cell research to science, doesn't mean that a scientist should be able to do stem cell research. Should questions are not issues for science, they're issues for theology, philosophy, ethics, pick your discipline. A discipline that thinks about those things. Now, perhaps, after we think about it, we'll decide that it's ethical to do stem cell research. I've written on this, I don't think that's true. But that's not a question for science. So we can already see in the area of ethics that science, though it's useful to compartmentalize it from other disciplines in one way, should not be totally compartmentalized from other disciplines. Since, after all, from a Christian perspective, all truth is God's truth. And compartmentalization exists for human convenience. We divide the world down, following Aristotle mostly, so that we can understand the world better and not be overwhelmed by the task. And different disciplines are doing different things, and they require different rules to be usefully employed. Now, what this means is that science, which became enamored with a particular idea in the 19th century and has continued to fruitfully follow that idea, has a very sophisticated take scientifically on reality that explains a great deal of the physical and biological evidence using a particular perspective. There are not enough scientists, I argued yesterday, who have been willing to dissent from that idea, but not just dissent, then do active, positive work looking at the world from a different perspective for one to expect that alternatives to that idea, which have proven to be, that idea has proven to be resilient and fruitful and gone on for some time, for any alternative to exist. But I agree with the Harvard philosopher, anti-creationist, certainly no friend of traditional religion, W.V. Quine, that science is capable of multiple incompatible interpretations for the same body of evidence. As a result, the fact that science by itself has a problematic, it has problems, but workable picture of biological reality is not by itself determinative for me, that I have to believe it. Because there could be other disciplines outside of science that would give me powerful motivation to seek this possible alternative picture of the evidence. Now, what have I just said? That science by itself has a workable scheme to explain much of biological and physical reality. We'll just call it evolutionary theory. The scheme, however, has important problems. It isn't complete. If it were complete, that would be a very powerful argument in its favor. Now, these problems by themselves, get the tape of yesterday, would not cause me to abandon evolutionary theory if I were committed to it. They would become research problems. However, their existence, plus the possibility that alternatives can happen in any meta-scientific view, combined with important philosophical and theological problems with embracing Darwinian theories, make it rational, in my opinion, to attempt to create an alternative science, an alternative series of explanations. And if we're going to do that, we might as well go all the way and pick one that fits best with the traditional Christian understanding of the text. Then, in fact, there's no sense going with half measures. What does the text say? What does our philosophy say? What are the problems we see in disciplines outside of pure science with embracing evolutionary theory? What are the problems, the research program itself inside of Darwinism, that we could use as an alternative start? In other words, what isn't explained here that can be explained here? How could we find oil better? How could we explain the fossil record better? Now, some young earth creationist scientists have expressed plausible and possible interpretations of the record that look like they might bear good fruit. But we can't know yet if they'll bear good fruit for one simple reason. The church hasn't encouraged enough people to go into science, or the people we've encouraged to go into science have become so overwhelmed by the sufficiency within science of Darwinian explanations that they don't stick with us. So the epistemological work I did yesterday, I hope, prepares you for this fact. We might be doing badly in one area with our explanations, but doing very well in another, and mediocre, a kind of mediocre research program in another area. And what you have to do is balance all the areas of life you're trying to explain, from the emotional to the rational to the physical, and get the best general interpretation of reality that you can. And my assessment is that on the whole, traditional Christianity, and I mean very traditional Christianity, where the Bible is assumed to be without error, and Genesis is assumed to be historical, bears the best fruit and likelihood of sustaining that kind of whole eudaimonia, flourishing, happiness in a human life. I won't look at any one discipline in isolation or any one problem in adopting the point of view that I have. Now, how can I say this? Plato argued in the middle of the symposium that human beings have a love deep within them that points them to something. And that something is never found to be a thing. You fall in love with a person, and it's good, but not quite enough. You love your city, and it's good, but it's not quite enough. You fall in love with laws, laws of science, laws of politics, laws and customs of your culture. And that's even better sometimes, but it's not enough. There exists inside of every human being a passion, a love that can only be satisfied by the good itself. Is love, Socrates famously asked, this love? Of something or of nothing? And the person he was speaking with says, of something, surely. It would be perverse to believe that you hunger and there never was food, that you thirst and there was never drink to satisfy. It is possible that we have a longing for the divine, and there is no divine. That nature has played a cruel trick on us. But why would we believe that unless we had to? The fact that it could be true doesn't mean that we should believe that nature is that perverse and chaotic. If we can maintain the belief that our deepest loves end somewhere, that my love for hope is real and not just an illusion, then I should continue to believe that if I can. And right away, we can see that purely materialistic science, untouched by any considerations of philosophy, psychology, or ethics, may be incapable of sustaining the deepest passion of humankind. That love that cannot be satisfied by anything in this life. This suggests to me a first motive for wanting not to make science a watertight compartment untouched by any other discipline or the considerations of any other discipline, but part of a bigger, more whole life. And I would feel this way even if I weren't a traditional Christian. And then we discover that the existence of that something can be sustained by philosophical arguments, the existence of God. Whether these philosophical arguments are by themselves totally conclusive, any individual one of them, is not important. That they can be maintained and have been maintained over centuries against all objections and continue to be living possibilities suggests that unlike Santa and Superman, rational people are capable of continuing to believe in the existence of God because they can give reasons beyond their personal experience, which I think counts more than anything else. They're longing for the divine and they're meeting God like I did at 8 years old when I crawled up onto my dad's lap and told him I did not want to go to hell when I died. And he introduced me to God. It is possible that I was mistaken about this deep encounter of the divine, so deep that I would find it impossible to doubt that it happened, even if I doubted the explanation that I met God. The deepest experience of my life. It could be a falsehood, but since I can sustain it, against philosophical objections, why would I abandon it? And yet, if there is such a God, then many things that cannot be considered if there isn't such an agent in the universe become open possibilities to me, so that I can consider vast alternatives. In fact, so many alternatives are open that some critics of creationism say, given what you're willing to consider, how will we ever prune down the number of theories that can be produced? Why am I a young earth creationist? Because God left us a holy Bible that described enough of human history to prune down the possibilities of what God could have done so that science would be possible. He did not leave us with only a possibility of what an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent being would do. He told us what he did. And even then, of course, he leaves humankind with the joy and privilege of trying to figure out how he did what he did and what he did. Why doesn't God drop down from heaven a complete flood geology? Because what would Kurt Wise do if he did that? It is the joy of humankind to solve puzzles and search out mysteries. Go read Proverbs. This is not, in a proper universe, a cause for doubt or concern. The I don't know is fun. Who wants to read a book that they understand the first time they read it? Sometimes I do. But that's the equivalent of watching Gilligan's Island reruns. You go home, you're exhausted after a day of seminary, and you hope that Nick at Night is showing Gilligan's Island reruns. Because there, in perfectly predictable order, occurs a kind of mindless entertainment that you understand the moment you turn on the show. From the opening theme song to the very end, you know several things. Are they going to get off the island? No. Is the dialogue going to be difficult to follow? No. Will the story make any sense at all? No. Will Gilligan mess everything up? Yes. Will Marianne look better than Ginger? Absolutely. All the way through. Sorry, the last one is more debatable, but there you go. Truth is truth. That kind of entertainment is fun in a particular mood, isn't it? But who would want to consume... No, don't answer this question. Who would want to consume the equivalent of Gilligan's Island all the time? I hope you're not that kind of person. Because it's the joy of humankind to face a puzzle and attempt to solve it. To understand, to think, don't you love the fact that you can't go to a Shakespeare play and get all of it the first time? In fact, you may get almost none of it the first time, even if you're reading along. But then even after you master the language, even the Elizabethan audiences that may have understood everything on one level the first time could not have possibly exhausted the meaning of to be or not to be, or the journey to the undiscovered country, or the jests. There was just more and more and more. And isn't that glorious? God does not cheat humanity out of the ability to make scientific discoveries. Because in an unfallen world, such an ability would be all pleasure with no pain. Our mistakes, even. And there's no reason to think that if we were unfallen, you'd go into a carpenter shop and make perfect measures and build perfect chairs. Mistakes of that sort, learning to build a chair, are not sins. They're not imperfections. They're joyful. Bad news, when you get to heaven, you probably aren't going to be the world's greatest basketball player. Who would want to be good at everything immediately? You see, it's that kind of possibility of growth, of discovery, that for humans who are time-bound, makes life worth living. And so God didn't give us a full flood geology, but He did tell us that there was a global flood in the days of Noah, so that the possibilities, which are nearly infinite, of creating scientific explanations would be constrained by biblical history. And when we reject biblical history and yet embrace a designer who is omnipotent and omniscient, we actually reject an ability to think about the world with any constraints at all. The possibilities become so infinite that science would fracture into too many small disciplines, too many small alternatives to develop workable views. The final result of what I'm saying in this part of my talk is this. You don't have to be right to think about the world in an interesting way. I pointed out yesterday that science has advanced by rejecting one false idea in favor of another false idea. You remember that with geocentrism and heliocentrism? In the same way, Christians have too often wanted the flood geology. But if I'm correct, what we really need are enough scientists to develop three or four alternative flood geologies that fight with each other, all four of which turn out to be wrong. What harm? If they were fruitful and faithful. Now, what are these outside theological or philosophical considerations that would lead me to embrace young earth creationism? And fortunately, most of you are aware of them, so we'll be able to move more quickly. The first is the problem of pain. When I started, I pointed out to you that the most difficult problem for a theist is the problem of evil. Or as C.S. Lewis describes it, the problem of pain. An old earth multiplies the problem of pain many, many times over. Anything that would reduce the amount of pain and suffering, seemingly gratuitous pain and suffering, that as a theist I have to explain, is very preferable to something that multiplies it. If Hugh Ross is right, then animals suffered excruciating pain as part of God's design plan. And yet animal suffering is more difficult to defend than human suffering. Human suffering doesn't even have to be evil as we gain moral lessons from it. It's growing pains, put one way. But animal souls, which are incapable, so far as we know, of this kind of moral development, that suffer gratuitous pain before the fall, before humankind introduces sin in the world, it's very difficult to understand in God's economy the purpose of gratuitous animal suffering. And yet the fossil record is replete with images of gratuitous animal suffering. I am not talking about death before the fall. Death before the fall might be explainable. But philosophically, pain and suffering before the fall in dumb beasts, beasts incapable of understanding what was happening to them, but capable of understanding pain, is a horrific problem for the traditional Christian. If I can develop a science that minimizes the problem of animal suffering, then I have an important reason to do it. Let me put it this way in an analogy. If you're unfortunate enough to have to use a Windows-based computer, you know there are two kinds of problems you can have. The first problem is you try to run one piece of software and you run another piece of software, it crashes the computer, so what do you have to do? Waste your time trying to download drivers, never solves your problem, just creates new ones. Or you simply no longer run the two programs simultaneously. You know there's a problem, and if you had time, you'd fix it. But you need to do your job so you live with some incompatibility. Or, horror of horrors, you can get the blue screen of death, which appears and starts doing the weird number thing it does, counting up or down, whichever way it goes. And you know that if that keeps happening, you've got to purge your hard drive and start again. There's no doing your work with the blue screen of death. Let me suggest to you that developing an alternative science is a big compatibility problem, but it's not a blue screen of death problem. Because Christians can even use traditional science, science as it's understood by the mainstream, while saying, yes, we don't think this is right, but it's useful for right now, so we're going to use it in the labs, even though we don't believe it's true. We're just going to use it. It's the way people do science right now, so let's use that. We think it's wrong, but we're going to use it, while paying other people at places like AIG to begin to develop an alternative and truer picture of science. This is not great. On the whole, it would be a reason to reject our view of the world. But it's not awful like the problem of pain, which is fundamentally, if it can't be solved, a blue screen of death problem. You can't believe in the God of the Bible at all if the problem of evil is sustained. So that to make this deep, deep root problem worse by believing in millions of years of gratuitous pain and suffering, much of which drives the very process of creation, is to paint a picture of God that is, in my opinion, infinitely, nearly, more difficult to resolve than finding enough bench scientists and theorists to rethink the world. Third, we have the witness of sacred scriptures, which should shape everything we do. Why do I say that? Simply because I gratuitously want sacred scriptures to shape everything I do? Yeah, partly. that's worked well for me. So of course I want to maintain it. I don't deny that. Hooray for the Bible. I like the Bible. I want it to be true. Given that, why shouldn't I try to defend it? I love my wife. I want her to be beautiful. Why shouldn't I try to defend her against attacks? But secondly, the Bible seems to accurately describe the human condition again and again and again. It seems to accurately describe history in those areas, particularly the Greco-Roman world, where we can test it against external criticism. Because it both works for me, seems to work culturally, and seems to be true whenever I can test it. It rings true time and time again. Why wouldn't I try to develop an alternative view of science that maintains those portions of biblical history, which are, after all, very small when looked at as the total of the biblical text, against critics? Think of how glorious it would be if we developed an alternative science that worked better in the real world, that found more oil, that cured more diseases, that developed more things and led to more human flourishing and created a sustainable human culture where all people created in the image of God were treated with justice, where creation was cared for as creation and not just an external to be manipulated for human needs, where God's design plan was recognized. Why wouldn't I want such an alternative science? And why do I read Scripture this way? First, because though Genesis has mythic elements, it is not mythic. Myth I do for a living. I have my PhD in one of the greatest myths ever written. And though Genesis contains elements that are mythic, by which I don't mean false, I mean deep, deep archetypes that speak to the human condition, like those we find in stories like the Cinderella. Though Genesis has mythic elements, which we would expect, so does the life of Jesus. Any great story contains these elements. It also contains details like the genealogies, or in the flood story, the actual size of the ark, that are unnecessary in purely mythic composition. It reads mythic plus. It does not read as pure myth. And those that advocate that Genesis be read that way, both within my own denomination and the denomination I was recently associated with, the Episcopal Church USA, always skip over the details. We have plenty of flood stories, but few flood stories that tell you the size, exact size and shape of a plausible boat-like structure. The Epic of Gilgamesh is, for example, somewhat like the myth of Genesis, only less plausible. I can only say that flood geologists' problems would be multiplied infinitely and the details made infinitely less plausible if any other flood mythology were to be adopted. They are mostly mythic, with almost no plausible detail. I would argue that the picture of Noah in Genesis and the picture of the boat in Genesis sounds like it's real. And it is only the implausibility of a global flood or of miracles to a secular age that make the story sound implausible at all. Secondly, if I were to adopt a myth and evolutionary theory were viewed to be true, I would not adopt the myth of Genesis. I would pick the myth developed by Empedocles. If liberal Bible scholarship is true, then Genesis reached its final edited form around the same time that the pre-Socratic philosopher Empedocles created a creation myth wholly compatible with neo-Darwinian theory. If God intended to describe the creation of the world mythically, then he made recourse to a mythic structure that is creationist and not a mythic structure that is theistic, yet evolutionary, like that of Empedocles. God was a bad selector of myth if God was picking myth. And yet, if we are to believe liberal Bible scholarship, he made no use of a theory that was available to the Jewish people around the same time that they put Genesis in its final form. This is implausible to me. Finally, we have the witness, nearly universal, of everyone who read the Bible before the 18th century as to how it should be interpreted as a test case. Those church fathers, see St. Augustine, who can be argued to have read some parts of Genesis metaphorically, did so under enormous Neoplatonic pressure. And those parts of their work that did that were the least cited, least useful parts for the church for most of the life of the church, till people in the 20th and 21st century decided to themselves accommodate with evolutionary theory. So that books that had been long available only to specialists, like Augustine's several versions of On a Literal Genesis, became widely cited and quoted, indicative of the fact that from Aquinas backwards, almost no great church father read the Bible in Genesis as being anything other than a historical account, except when they were under pressure from external philosophical positions that seemed to make Genesis implausible. Whenever we have interpreted Scripture this way, this has proven to be a long-term embarrassment to the church. Men and women are equally created in God's image. But best science, for most of human history, argued that women were imploded men. Men gone bad. That only men were fundamentally males, created in God's image. This scientific belief seemed incompatible with Genesis. The good news is that the universal church refused to view sexuality as a bad thing, condemned the condemnation of sexuality. From sacred scriptures forward, maintained the belief that though they may have different functions in God's economy, men and women are equally created in the image of God, so that wherever it went, Christianity proved to be a liberating force for women who could be priests in the ancient world, but not citizens. Christians may have said that in God's economy, women could not be priests, but made them citizens, because they were fully and equally human. Whenever we have accommodated with the spirit of our age, and some of the fathers did accommodate with the misogyny of what seemed to be best science, those church fathers are now an embarrassment to us to this day. Which suggests to me that it is better for traditional Christians to engage in the harder work of developing alternative explanations than to do the easier work of developing plausible accommodations. But I'll tell you this, theistic evolution is cheaper in terms of human capital and thought than young earth creationism. Young earth creationism, to be sustained, needs many creation museums, but it also needs many universities and colleges dedicated to research with hundreds and hundreds of scientists thinking about the world in a new way, writing hundreds of research papers in scores of conferences every year. This is such a hard job that the temptation is overwhelming to ignore the philosophical, theological, and biblical problems and embrace the easier way. And if that's what you must do to maintain a basic Christian faith, then good for you. But I don't expect in 500 years, if Jesus tarries, that we'll look back at what you did as having been useful to the culture, to science, or to the universal life of the church. In fact, your books and writings may prove to be a deep embarrassment to our inability to stand against a plausible but wrong idea when it plainly contradicted the plain sense of Scripture. And so, I leave you with this. We long for something we cannot have in this life. We long for a beloved we cannot easily see. And I think that this longing is not just a romantic notion. It's not just something we tack on to the beginning and end of a sermon to move people's hearts. It is the essence of what makes science possible. The essence of science is love. A love to know and to understand. You see, if I told you that I passionately love my wife Hope, but I told you next that I did not know the color of her eyes, they're blue. By the way, you still don't know the color of her eyes. You've only heard me tell you. And if you want to love Hope, that isn't good enough. You'd need to see her face to face. If I told you I loved her, and I didn't want to know everything about her, you would know that I was a liar. Yes, knowledge is not love, but knowledge will always follow love. The sun isn't light, but the sun makes light. Love can theoretically be had without knowledge. When I saw her across the room for the first time, she seized my soul. But the next thought I had was, I want to know that woman. Don't tell me, brothers and sisters, that your congregation loves Jesus if they don't have any interest in theology. Because the lover always wants to know the beloved. It's the next step. And in the same way, God pronounced His creation good. And though His creation isn't God, if God loves a thing, then I will love it and want to know about it. In the same way that when I married Hope, she had friends and interests. Band music. Band music. Ah! But she loved it. And if you love her, you will love band music or perish, because you're going to hear a lot of it anyway. And I'll tell you this, if you can learn to like coffee, which the first time I drank it, I thought they had burnt a rope and put it in water. I decided that God punished grown-ups because He no longer let them drink soda pop. He made them drink coffee. It's part of original sin or something working itself out in the world. But I so wanted to be a grown-up that I learned to cultivate an understanding of that delicious flavor. I made my palate more sophisticated. I broadened my joys and my hopes and my dreams to embrace something new so that I could hang with the people I admired. In the same way, if we love God, we'll love science. Because God loves His world, we will love His creation as a secondary love and want to understand it. Love is hard. My grandfather was a very strong and powerful man. And when he died, my grandmother, after 50-some years, was left alone. And at the funeral, people say things at funerals and they don't mean to be bad. I was sitting behind her. And someone came up and said, Sybil, it's just as good in one way, though hard, that Shelby's gone. Because he was so sick. And it must have been so hard on you to care for him. And I saw my grandmother's bent back straighten and her brown eyes flash like fire. And she said this, and I'll never forget it. I would do all the difficult labor for 20 years. if I could have 10 more minutes with him. How could this be when the job was so difficult and so hard and so distasteful and gross? It is because she loved him. And so it is that today, and in your pastorates or seminary work, I have called you to a hard and sometimes gross and difficult cleanup of science, of human thought, a task that will not end until your death, because we will make bad mistakes this side of paradise. But I have experienced, and I believe you know, that until we die, for the love of God, and for the love of His creation, for the love of the people around us, this hard and difficult task is worth it, because it images for us the love that moves the heavens and the furthest stars. Thank you, and God bless you.